Hello, this is Donovan Bigelow again, and this is part two of the basic lecture on the classic Freudian method. I want to now take the next hour or so and talk about the specifics of the way Freud's theory of mind evolved over time. And it's really important you understand that he didn't have one theory of mind, that he began listening to his patients, sort of following his phenomenological method, his listening and looking and careful observation of the patient and the patient's mind that he was talking to. And he evolved a perspective, and then he did it some more, and then he learned some more. And so I think you could divide his way of theorizing about the human mind into five sections. And let me go through each of them. We call them the five perspectives. And the first is called the topographical model. Now, what that means is quite simply this, that we have consciousness. Everybody gets that. This is me, I'm sitting here now, I'm thinking about this, that, and the other thing. And most people before Freud thought that's who we are. Freud, remember, discovered the details, didn't discover the unconscious, but discovered, was the first to really explore the details of it. So now we have conscious and unconscious, this opening up of a profound and deep and often dark psychic reality where most of the human mind is functionings can be located. But we also had a preconscious, something in the middle, something I think now we would say RAM, rapid access random access memory. I'm not very technologically sophisticated, but it's just memory. If I ask you, what's your birthday? And you tell me, the question was, where was that information before I asked you the question? It wasn't in your conscious mind, but it clearly wasn't in your unconscious because you had rapid access to it. So Freud needed a way to explain that kind of memory, so he came up with preconscious. Conscious, preconscious, unconscious, the topographic model. And initially, that's all Freud had. This discovery of the unconscious was a profound thing, and he thought that just about everything in his patients' pathologies and everything in normal people's lives could be explained using that model. And that's down the road he went. And then, of course, very quickly, his patients showed him a level of complexity that could not be explained by his theory. So he changed the theory, as I said, and realized, and this was, I think, one of his most profound developments, that of development. Again, before Freud, everyone thought that children were just little adults who hadn't grown up yet, and that they weren't treated particularly differently, and with disastrous results quite often. What Freud realized is that from birth, and possibly even before, that children have very specific developmental phases to go through. Now, unfortunately, he called this the genetic model of mind, and he didn't know very much about genetics. Genetics was barely a field then, certainly nothing of our modern understanding of genetics, and unfortunately that word now has gotten so saturated with the now more literal scientific study of genetics, chromosome, genes, DNA, that Freud's use of the term is often quite confusing. So just as long as we're clear that when Freud says genetic, all he really means is developmental. He's not implying chromosomes or genetic manipulation in the way we would think of it, like in the Human Genome Project or something like that. So for Freud, genetics simply meant developmental. And you've all heard, probably, of Freud's stages of development. Oral, anal, phallic, latency, adolescence, and adulthood. Freud did have a bit of a linear frame of mind, that you move through these phases. You have to move through them successfully to get to the next phase. If you don't, if you get, as he said, fixated at one stage, or having achieved a certain stage, you regress back to the other. That's how he came to understand mental illness, that you were either fixated or regressed to an earlier developmental stage, a more primitive stage, and that was what mental illness really meant. If you regressed too far to psychosis, to schizophrenia, you regressed all the way back to almost an infancy, a mental infancy level. I think the modern thinkers no longer think in a linear way, and we can criticize Freud for thinking in a linear way, but it was what we cannot lose track of is that nobody at all in his era thought developmentally at all. So this was a monumental leap, which, again, standing on his shoulders, we have now become more sophisticated at understanding and researching. So I think there we are. Development. Let's go through the specifics of what in Freud's day was an absolutely revolutionary way of thinking about human mental development and personal growth and psychic growth. Freud was not very creative in his usage of names for these various phases. It was pretty obvious. The oral phase. Let me think. From birth to 2 years, what is the child doing? What is the main focus of a baby's world? It's the mouth. It's the breast. It's the nipple. Everything that the baby gets in its little hands, where does it go? Into the mouth. Freud looked at all this and went, let's call it the oral phase. It's almost amusing in its simplicity. Freud then noticed something shifted around 2 years, about the time most children started to become potty trained. Now, this, Freud realized, was the first big conflict between the child and the adults, the first real one. The child has always defecated where it wanted to, and now it's being told it has to defecate there and not there. This generates conflicts inside the child's mind. This generates a feeling of conflict, of even persecution almost, if it's too aggressive, and generates a response in fantasy on the child's part. And so navigating the potty training turns out to be a very important developmental phase. The next phase has been the source of most conflict and most critique about Freud, the what he called the phallic phase. And this is the phase, also the phase within which he first postulated the Oedipus complex. And we're going to spend some time trying to understand that without hysteria. It has become the subject of sort of loss of sanity almost in the field. People have either committed to it or they've hysterically rejected it and flamed it in criticism. My job today is just to bring us back down to earth, describe what Freud was trying to do, describe where he went wrong, describe what maybe he got right, or at least what maybe is worth thinking about more. So here it is, the phallic phase. And this is the phase where the little boy and the little girl realize, A, they're a little boy or a little girl. And for most little boys and little girls, that's not a confusing thing. They realize and they identify with the father or the mother, depending on their biology. There is much ink being spilt today on gender identity disorders and the whole question of plastic sexuality and whether you can change genders and what that's all about. And I will put all of that complicated material off for another lecture where I will spend at least 2 hours dedicated to the idea of sexuality itself. Let me limit this discussion to introducing Freud's idea in this area, and we'll be more specific about it later. Suffice to say that the little boy, the little girl, discovers their genitals and the fact of their gender identity. And Freud saw in the classic Greek trilogy about Oedipus the king, Oedipus Rex, Oedipus at Colonus by Sophocles, a literary rendition, a metaphor for this earliest childhood developmental phase. Freud believed that the Oedipus complex, as he called it, was the fundamental, the nuclear complex through which every child, boy or girl, had to go through to reach adult healthy maturity. If something went wrong during the phallic phase, if the Oedipus complex could not be resolved in a healthy way, then some form of neurosis, some form of mental illness was virtually inevitable and would have to be resolved through therapy or something at some point in the adolescent or the adult's life. So here it is. And I'm going to assume that my audience has some familiarity with the Oedipus complex. Look it up. You can go to Wikipedia and look up the Oedipus complex, look up the story of Oedipus, and the great and powerful myth written by Sophocles, which to this day is still fascinating, to this day still tells us something about relationships between mothers and fathers and children, and what it means to be an adult and conflicts within us and between us and all of our relationships and generations. I commend it to you all. The idea is, we'll start with the little boy. The little boy realizes that it has a penis, and that makes it like father. But it also realizes that mother and father are doing something that he, the little boy, for the first time, is excluded from. Now, this is a troubling thing. Little boys and little girls have primitive fantasies of sexuality. Now, they don't know what mom and dad are doing behind closed doors, and they certainly shouldn't. You should never expose a child to adult sexuality. That will almost certainly result in some form of neurosis or pathology. That is very clear. 100 years of research can put that question to rest, I think, just about. But the little boy realizes that it's excluded. Now, this is the first time the child realizes that it is not in a unique one-on-one symbiotic relationship with the mother. That the unique oneness with the mother, all of a sudden, through physiological maturation, through development of more complex neuronal structures in the brain, through the accumulation of life experience, through the development of speech and perception, all of these complex physiological and emotional developmental tracks all come together, and the child at about age 3.5 realizes, oh my goodness, it isn't just me and mom, and these other figures out in my life actually have relationships that I am excluded from. And right away, the little boy says, wait a minute, that makes me mad. That makes me frustrated. I don't like that. I'm supposed to have this unique, special relationship with mom. I'm supposed to be what it's all about. And here I am all by myself when mom and dad are behind closed doors. I'm like dad. I have a penis. Dad is giving something to mom, and I should be able to do that. Wait a minute, I'm in competition with dad now. He and mom are together. I used to be together with mom. I'm going to try to replace dad. I'm going to, yeah, that's it. It's going to be me and mom, and dad's the bad guy now, and I'm going to be in competition with dad. And you find little boys now becoming mama's little favorite and trying to move in between mom and dad. I have a now 10-year-old stepson. When he was about 3.5, 4, or 5, his mother and I were together, and I would give her a hug in the morning in the kitchen, and he would try to worm his way in between us, and I would say, mine, and he would say, mine, and hang on, and it was actually cute and fun. But I understood underneath there were serious things going on in this young boy's mind, and he had to figure out how to navigate those terrors. And that's what they were, because what happens in the little boy's mind is, wait a minute, and this is all according to Freud's theory, is that dad is big and I'm little. And if I push this too far, if I push this competition with dad too far, I could be in trouble. I could be castrated. The thing that makes me a boy could be taken from me. Because look at my little sister. She doesn't have a penis. Maybe she's already been castrated. So this fantasy of castration anxiety, according to Freud, comes up in the little boy's mind. And it's so terrifying that he represses his desire for his mother. And that's the developmental resolution of the Oedipus complex. The identification with the father. The repression of the competition. The fantasy that, well, I'm going to grow up and be like dad, and then I'm going to get my own woman who's a lot like mom, and then I'll be happy, and then I'll be like dad. And isn't it amazing how young boys grow up and find a woman so much like their mother? It seems almost inevitable. If there was any kind of decent relationship between the mother and the son, it appears that the taking in of that image of the mother, that taking in of the maternal object, as we say, ends up when the child becomes an adolescent and turns toward the outside to find love. Who does he find? A woman that resonates with that very image of his first love, the mother. And so, how else do you explain young men finding women whose characteristics are remarkably, remarkably like their own mothers most of the time? Are there exceptions? Sure. A difficult relationship might drive a son to find someone very different. But doesn't that still suggest that the son is reacting to the mother's object, the internalized mother, either favorably or unfavorably? The internalized image of the mother still drives the son's train when it comes to adult relationships. So if it works out okay, if the father is there to sort of contain the son's anxiety, to be clear that he cannot win the Oedipal complex, Oedipal struggle, he has to repress the anxiety around castration anxiety, and then enters the next phase, which is called latency, where those dynamics seem to cool, where they become internalized. And between age 6 and 10 or 11, the little boy becomes rather docile, rather pleasant. Grade school is not a time for much crisis or acting out. It seems a period of consolidation and growth. We think there is a lot going on, but it seems quiescent in some ways. If all goes well, the boy then reaches adolescence, and these internalized objects of the mother and father get acted out in its adolescent love relationships, and off it goes to hopefully healthy adulthood. That's the resolution of the Oedipus complex for the young boy, as Freud laid it down, and that's a very brief version of it. What does the little girl do? The little girl has almost a mirror image developmental sequence. The little girl realizes, in exactly the same way, special relationship with mother. Wait a minute, now there's father. I'm not the only one in my mother's universe. In fact, not only am I not the only one, not only is there a father, but they actually have something going on that I'm excluded from, that I'm left out of. And the little girl has some very similar dynamics. But according to Freud now, she realizes that she doesn't have a penis and that she's like mom and she identifies with the mom. But that puts her in competition with the mom for daddy's attention. So she worms her way in between and very often becomes daddy's little girl at that point. And mother is often distanced and punished and conflict happens between 3, 4, and 5 between the little girl and her mother. Same thing happens with the little girl. She realizes that she can't have what daddy's giving mommy and that she's got to repress that anger and that anxiety. And it goes into a latency phase until adolescence and then the blossoming of biological sexuality and the finding of an external object different from the internalized parental ones. It sounds very parallel. Most modern thinkers now are in agreement that the Oedipus complex, the Oedipus situation, as we now understand it, seems to be quite equal between the boys and the girls. The one difference that seems to be still troubling is that the boy, in his autonomy, is assisted by the fact that he identifies with the already separate father. That it's easier for the boy in some ways to pull away from the mother because of the identification with the father. What the girl must do is separate from the mother that she very completely identifies with. And so some have argued that this is the phenomenon that Freud saw, and this is how he explained it. And the evolutionary psychologists might have a completely different explanation. That it has to do with the evolved adaptivity of the emotional connections of women that had an adaptive advantage in our tribal culture. Freud suggested it was a question of psychic, unconscious identification. Two theories coming from very different paradigms see the same dynamic, the difficulty, the seemingly greater difficulty that young girls have of establishing an autonomous sense of self vis-a-vis the mother than the boy has, and they explain it differently. Now, I've got to address the question of what Freud said was penis envy. Now, he was wrong about that. There's nobody that doubts that today. But what he does not get credit for is the same idea, that he saw something powerful, he saw something important, he saw something real in his adult female patients' minds. He saw envy, and it was poisonous, and it was difficult for them. Women in Freud's practice very frequently and very powerfully envied the men in their lives. Well, we look back now and say, well, why shouldn't they? Back then, women didn't have a right to property, they didn't have a right to vote, they didn't have a right to much of anything they weren't given by their men. It was a painfully traditional society for women. And what, of course, would they not envy that men's freedom, men's power, men's control of the money, men's control of the land, men's control of politics at every level? I mean, the envy should be obvious to any observer at all. And it wasn't. to anybody but Freud. Men didn't see women and their envy. They just saw women in their place. Freud saw women doing something that no other physician had seen. He saw this emotional dynamic that was painful, was destructive, was generating pathology. And he's a scientist. Very early on, he tried to be a loyal scientist, and he said, "Women envy men. What do men have that women don't? A penis. Penis envy." And he wrote it down like that, and there it stuck, and generations of women analysts ever since have been giving him grief for it. Let's cut him some slack. What he saw and what was important that he see was the envy. He just put the wrong label on it. But he gets credit for seeing something no other physician saw, an emotional dynamic in women that he could take seriously, that he could respect, that he wanted to understand. And through that, his women patients got help where no one else in Europe would help them. So, okay, we can make fun of Freud and his penis envy. But we have to be careful, because under the surface, the entire episode shows his respect for women, his respect for their minds, and we can't throw the method out with the mistaken label, I think. Okay. So we go on to latency, and then adolescence, where biologically the next bloom happens, and the sense of identification laid down, the sense of identity laid down by identification with the parents in the earlier years, now blossoms out into identification with the adolescent groups, friends, social acquaintances, and the early elements of the young adolescent's adult identity start taking shape. You hit adulthood, Freud thought around 18. We now, in our late culture, seem to think young men and women aren't able of being, aren't achieving meaningful adulthood until their mid-20s, sometimes, sadly, quite beyond that. But Freud thought by 18, everybody should be mostly in the adult phase. The take-home lesson for Freud's genetic model of mind is of the utmost importance, and that is the early phases of development are overwhelmingly the most important. That you must get the prenatal 9 months right, you must get the first 3 or 4 years as right as you can. And if you can, then the child will become an adolescent who will become an adult who at most has some standard human neurotic conflicts, but they can manage them adequately without illness, mental illness. Fail our children early, and we fail them to some degree permanently. We now recognize, even the child developmental specialists who are not Freudians have admitted that the evidence is clear. There are sensitive periods, there are critical periods in the baby, the toddler, and the early child's development, within which, if that child does not get what they need, there are severe, serious, and possibly permanent ramifications in terms of that child's character development, psychopathology. This is where autism starts. This is where all the major mental illnesses start. It now is, I think, beyond dispute. There's very little disagreement in the entire field of psychology now that virtually every serious mental illness ultimately stems from catastrophic failure of nurturing care in the earliest 2 or 3 or 4 years of life. The variations are minor. My field now is split all over the place on a lot of issues. This one, I think it's fair to say that the overwhelming majority of clinicians, researchers, child developmental specialists are all in agreement that you must get the earliest years right or the child is set up for significant pathology. And I immediately get flooded with panicked parents and angry parents saying that can't be true because I'm putting my child in daycare at 6 months and that it's got to be okay because I have to go to work. And I've heard these stories endlessly, and they're often tragic, and they're often sad, and they're often the source of such pain and suffering by everyone involved. Freud's reality principle must be maintained. Your needs do not meet the child's needs. Meeting the child's needs meets the child's needs. And if you're doing that, then good. And if you're not, there will be problems. And there's no ideology that's going to fix that. There's no denial that's going to make that not true. So we have to do what we have to do to live, that's true. But we're going to spend a great deal of time in a subsequent lecture on the question of specifically and exactly what children need to develop into healthy, whole individuals. And one of the most important truths that Freud discovered early was the absolute importance of the earliest 3 or 4 or 5 years of life, developmental importance of those years for adult healthy functioning. I think I've already touched sufficiently on the importance of sexuality and aggression. It probably bears another mention. And maybe in our culture now it isn't necessary, but this clarification may help. Freud was attacked viciously, actually viciously, when he suggested that children, especially through the Oedipus complex, have ideas about sexuality with their parents. And I think he was simply willfully misunderstood. I think people just freaked out about the idea of children thinking any sexual thoughts at all, shut down that thought in their own minds, were in catastrophic denial about it. And now I think calmer heads can prevail. The simple truth is children ages 2, 3, 4, 5 have sexual thoughts. They have discovered their bodies. The child researchers are now scientifically able to confirm, virtually without exception, after decades of research, of careful infant and early childhood observations in labs, in homes, thousands and thousands and thousands of children being observed by tens of thousands of professional observers. Children masturbate by the time they are 18 months to 2 years old. Boys and girls discover the neurological development of their clitoris and penis, and I'm sorry, but they enjoy it and they touch themselves, and all of our moral beliefs to the contrary and all of our dangerous attempts to punish that out of these young children, which frankly often turns into sexual perversion and pathology later, runs counter to Freud's great wisdom in realizing that this is normal, this is inevitable. This has to be carefully channeled. This has to be contained. This has to be understood for what it is. But the hysterical overreaction of folks whose ideologies, whose personal insecurities cause them to overreact in their children's development causes dramatically more problems than it solves. And that's where psychology and psychologists and people like me lecturing like this may be getting into some trouble. But if I have any respect for science, I have to tell the truth as the science and the evidence lays it out. And in this case, Freud was right about the power of psychosexuality, even in very young children. And I would suggest if you don't believe it, go talk to early daycare workers, go talk to nurses, go talk to mothers who have had some honest experience with their own very young children, and you will find that there is something going on, quite obviously sexual, in very young children. And the best we can do is deal with our own reaction to that and help our children transition those developmental stages with as much health and caring and containment as we can. Okay. We've talked about the topographic model, conscious, unconscious, and preconscious. We've talked about the genetic model, the oral, anal, phallic, and the other stages of development. We've talked about the libido theory, that life energy theory, and its development through the Oedipus complex for boys and girls. We now move to what's called the dynamic perspective. Now, this is fairly simple, actually, thank goodness. The dynamic perspective was a leftover of Freud's scientific model, of his sort of energy model, that if you push something down here, something comes up here. It has sort of a hydraulic feel to it. You push down here, you push up there. If you repress and deny all sexuality, you end up with a perversion squeaking out the side somewhere. So the idea that the energy is contained and has to go somewhere is part of his dynamic understanding of mental functioning. His economic perspective, the fourth perspective, is about, again, energy, But the idea here is there's only so much of it. And this also makes common sense, I think. You work hard all day long, you go home, you're tired. Well, this is obvious. Freud's idea was that you have libido, this life energy flowing around you, and he never was very good at explaining exactly what that was, and we don't tend to think of it in those kind of terms at all anymore. But the take-home lesson, I think, in the economic theory still retains some validity. If you only have so much energy, and it's in dynamic relation to itself in some ways, then if you put your energy toward one endeavor, you don't have much left over for something else. This, in some ways, seems patently obvious now. It is part of our cultural understanding of mental functioning. You only have so much energy. And that means, think of it as money. Think of it, if you've got $100 in the bank, you have to parse it out in intelligent ways or you end up in trouble. The trouble Freud was dealing with was psychopathology. Not enough energy to deal with growth. Not enough energy to work. Not enough energy for love. Not enough energy for creativity. So we have to be careful about how we spend our precious energy. In 1923... Freud put the capstone on his models of the mind, his five points of view. He wrote a book called The Ego and the Id. And that developed what effectively is his final formulation. After 1923, he made some changes and expanded some other areas. But in terms of mental functioning, the structural model of the mind was his final contribution. And that's what we call it, the structural model. And that involves terms you've probably heard before, the id, the ego, and the superego. Now let's be clear. These are fantasies. These are functions. These are how the mind works. Freud never postulated a thing in the mind, in the brain, a part of the brain that was the superego as a thing in the mind. He never, ever suggested anything of the sort. He suggested this way of understanding the mind as split, as having different functions that did different things that were very often in quite hostile and difficult conflict with each other. And again, this is how he saw the mind work. This is how he saw what it was doing. These are the labels he put on what he saw. So we may disagree with the label, but it's hard to argue that he didn't observe accurately what his patients were doing, how their minds were functioning. Again, subsequent lectures will show how most thinkers now don't think entirely in these terms. We've modified it rather dramatically, but this is the model of the mind upon which the vast majority of subsequent models of the mind were modeled, and we have to understand it or the later innovations make much less sense. What is the id? Now, these are Latin terms that translate from that were translated from the German into Latin and then English, and they're, because of this multiple translations, a bit confusing. Das Es is the German word for id, and it simply means the it, the thing inside us, our sexual and aggressive instincts. The cauldron of aggression, the cauldron of sexuality, the deep, dark, unconscious dynamics, the caveman on our shoulder, the little devil on our shoulder that wants it and wants it now, the one that won't be told no, the one that has to be controlled or it would run amok. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. This is the Mr. Hyde part of us. Again, literary figures sort of getting a handle on psychic functioning long before the psychologist did. Is that a bad thing? Is the it a bad thing? And of course not. It's not a devil on your shoulder. It's not a bad. It's not morally bad. It's absolutely and utterly essential to life. We must have sexuality. We must have aggression. You can't get out of bed in the morning without aggression in its larger sense. So I want to get away from the idea that the superego, which is what we now understand as the conscience, the voice of the father and the mother sort of telling us not to steal, telling us to be good, okay? Generating guilt if we're not good, that's the superego's function. It's not a little angel, and it is not a little devil on our shoulder. That is just a completely moralizing and ideological and, in fact, religious way of thinking about the mind that Freud said mistakes the reality of mental functioning rather dramatically. The superego can be very bad. In fact, most people now understand that a harsh and punitive superego, which comes in through development, Freud thought through the resolution of the Oedipus complex, actually, that can generate depression. If the conscience is too strict, too severe, if you're bad, if you're evil, if you're not good enough, if no matter what you do, you're bad, if that's the message that you've taken in from your childhood, then you can develop a harsh and punitive superego that is never satisfied, that is always condemning, and down that road goes quite severe depression. So we're not talking about a little angel on your shoulder here. When it works, when it's healthy, when the ego has become strong enough to manage the superego, the conscience, and the id, that is the idea of health in Freud's theory of mind here. The whole point of therapy is to grow the ego. Now, we would call it the self today. You, the self, the ego. Do you have an adequate quantity of self-esteem? You. That's what Freud meant by the ego. And it was the ego's job to manage the id, to deal with the superego, and to manage reality. Now, it's an elegant, elegant model of mind. The ego is standing there. Let me use an example. I've used this in class before. The ego is standing there and walking across the street, let's say, and we see a beautiful woman walking across the street. And let's say I'm single and I see this beautiful woman. What does my id say? My id say, you want it now, go get her now. All right, little Jekyll and Hyde thing going on there. The superego, what does the superego say? Shame on you for having that thought, shame on you for even getting near that terrible thought. The conscious is primitive and brutal and demeaning, judgmental. The id is demanding as well and wants it now and will not be told no. The ego's job? Manage those two. The ego has to be strong enough because these folks can be powerful. So the ego has to be kept repressed, kept managed. You feel those sexual and aggressive drives, and the ego has to handle them and make sure they don't become overwhelming, or it's a Mr. Hyde kind of situation. Just as well, you have to deal with a superego, or you'll be overwhelmed with guilt and believe you deserve nothing in life, in which case you end up committing suicide or being in the middle of a major depressive disorder or other dysfunction. It can crush you, crush your spirit, crush your will. That cannot be allowed. The ego has to be strong enough to keep the superego at bay and say, okay, we will mind the rules of our fathers and mothers. We will obey the rules, but we get to live. And then the ego has got to manage reality. You can't just run out and grab her. You've got to deal with reality. You've got to look at the social conventions. You've got to walk up and start talking. You've got to be dressed appropriately. You've got to be well enough educated. These are all the things the ego has to do in reality. Now, I've just laid out an ego that's got a lot of work to do. Freud basically said that mental illness, in all of its varied forms, comes down to one thing: inadequate ego strength. Either my superego is my id is too strong, and that makes me a sociopath, a killer, a rapist. My superego is too strong for the ego to handle, and I become depressed or schizoid or withdrawn or something else. All right, or I can't handle reality, which happens way too often. So it's about ego strength. Now, what happens if the ego isn't strong enough? That's where the defense mechanisms are. The ego is in charge of the defense mechanisms. And if I can't handle the truth, then I get to deny, I get to displace, I get to project, I get to do something else that will allow me to manage without falling apart, because the whole point of the defenses is to ensure that the ego does not fall apart, to live to fight another day, to try to figure out how to get some therapy and get a little stronger. This is Freud's really elegant model of the mind. And this is the important part. He put all five of these points of view together. The topographic. There's an unconscious, a preconscious, and a conscious. And then you add the structural model. Well, the ego is partly conscious, but partly unconscious. The it is all unconscious. The superego is unconscious, but sometimes squeaks through to consciousness and makes you feel guilty. And then he integrates the economic and the dynamic, and he integrates the genetic, the developmental, and that's how it all forms. And so we have, quite frankly, a work of art. We have this elegant, beautiful, complex, no doubt about complex, model of the human mind that, at least in Freud's day, described almost everything of healthy, love, work, healthy people getting through their days. This explained how it happened. And simultaneously, this explained how mental illness happened. Some problem with the superego, some problem with an inability of the ego to contain the id, not strong enough to manage the conflicts that reality throws our way. You've got to admit, it's an elegant paradigm. And it provided the opportunity for Freud and his co-workers to intervene clinically. This model of mind directly resulted in the techniques of psychotherapy. If you don't know how it's put together, you can't fix it. You go to an auto mechanic. Something's going wrong in your engine. You don't have any idea what's going on. You take it to the auto mechanic, and what's the auto mechanic got to do? He or she's got to diagnose it, got to find out what's wrong. How do they do that? They know how it's put together. If you don't know how the engine's put together, you have no idea how to diagnose what's wrong, and therefore you don't have any idea how to fix it. That, ladies and gentlemen, is exactly what Freud's elegant model of the mind gave us, the ability to help people heal, the ability to fix mental illness. To the extent this theory reflected the reality of human mental functioning, it provided a way, a method, to fix it. Just like the mechanic, if he knows what's wrong, if he knows how it's put together, and he knows what's wrong, he knows how to get in there and repair. This model of mind allowed clinicians for the first time to intervene effectively to heal some of the worst forms of mental illness. So, let's transition now to therapy. And I will spend an entire lecture or two on therapy. I want to just briefly now cover the highlights of Freud's initial structuring of what therapy was supposed to look like. And here's the big issue up front. You must recognize that the type of therapy that you do comes directly from how you think the mind is put together. And I can't emphasize this enough, because there are many schools of therapy out there now. There's existentialist, there's cognitive behaviorist, there's all kinds of, I would call them fringe therapies. You can have art therapy, you can have theater therapy, you can have, I mean, people put crystals on each other and call it therapy. All of these therapies have one thing in common. They are a direct derivative of how the clinician thinks the mind is put together. If you do not have a good understanding of how the reality of mental functioning is, then you cannot fix anything you think is wrong. And this is where Freud's idea of the reality principle came in. He had two ideas that sort of drove his train for a lot of his life, the pleasure principle and the reality principle. And he thought most people were driven by the pleasure principle. We want pleasure and we want to avoid pain. Now, it doesn't take a genius to figure out he's onto something here. On the other hand, it wasn't entirely convincing, because people climb Mount Everest at great personal pain. So there's more going on than just pleasure and pain. Nietzsche would suggest that there's power involved, the will to power, that we want something beyond. Even the evolutionary psychologists realize that we sacrifice a great deal for higher goals. So pleasure principle seemed a little bit crude, but okay. The reality principle, this one seems still quite relevant. What you do, to the extent that it reflects how reality really works, then your solution is much more likely to work better in the real world. The closer your methods and techniques match reality, the more likely they are, in fact, to work. This seems obvious. But we have had 50 years of postmodern philosophy where the very idea of reality has been attacked that reality is just subjective. It's all what I just think it is. And one person's reality is just as good as another person's reality. That has not worked. It will not work. There is a separate, independent, experienced reality which we do not have clean and pure access to because of transference, as I referenced in the previous lecture, because of our accumulated experience, doesn't give our perception the ability to cleanly see perfect reality. So it's always a little muddy, I'll give you that. But what we don't get to do is pretend the reality principle doesn't exist and that the pleasure principle rules and we could have it any way we want it. Postmodern philosophy, if I may, is infantile, is delusional. One might wonder if it isn't pathological or derived from pathological dynamics. It is wish fulfillment in its most primitive form, only to the extent that we are grounded in reality. And again, it's never perfect, but it's something to strive toward. Will our therapy be effective? And will our lives have some semblance of hope at achieving something meaningful? That might be seen now as an ideological position in and of itself. I'm willing to grant that. This is, in my field, an area where we are not in agreement, and I confess that up front, pull any 10 psychotherapists into a room and you're going to get 6 or 8 or 10 or 12 different opinions about this technical fact. But it's an important technical fact, and it drives therapy all the time. People who are not grounded in reality, who believe in a radical subjectivity, they are going to do all kinds of things and call it therapy. Whether that works or not, I doubt. Those who can hold to some connection to reality are like much more likely to get real results. Okay, let's talk about the purposes of therapy. What are we really trying to do? And I think, let me at least juxtapose Freud's purpose with therapy and everybody else's. This is also the subject of some dispute in my field, but the classical form of therapy is in some ways deceptively simple. Its job was one thing and one thing only: help the patient understand their mind, bring to consciousness the unconscious dynamics of their mental functioning, help the patient understand it. That's it. Nothing beyond that. You don't tell the patient how to live. You don't try to stop them from doing anything. You don't try to make them do something else. You don't make them feel guilty about stuff they've done. You don't deprive them of their guilt feelings. You don't encourage them to do this. You don't discourage them from doing that. Your job is simply and solely to take a deep breath and, as best you can, structure a place of containment, the frame of the therapy within which the patient will feel safe enough and trust you enough to be able to explore and manage and deeply understand the functioning of their own mind and how they came to be that way. That's it. Anytime a therapist is telling a patient how to live, what to do, giving advice, being a life coach, criticizing a patient, moralizing with a patient, agreeing with a patient, disagreeing with a patient, all of these things are extra therapeutic. All of these things are outside the scope of honest, real, meaningful, deep psychoanalytic therapy. Lots of other therapists, lots of other methodologies, but this is where it has to start. And you may justify going in other directions. A lot of my colleagues do, and they have good arguments, and they do good work. But we have to start where the mind is in reality, and the purpose of this, of therapy, the way therapy was initially begun, was to do it this way, to do simply whatever work could be done in the context of how we understood the mind, to bring the unconscious to conscious awareness, to help the patient understand its mind. And Freud used a brief saying. He said, the only purpose of therapy is to assist the patient to love and to work. If they can do that, good enough. We aren't trying to create the new man or the new woman. We're just trying to help them love and work. It's a humble project. It's a humble project indeed. Freud said that the purpose of therapy is to help the patient to love and to work. And if you can do those two things, that's all we can expect of therapy or human experience. There was another analyst named Kohut in Chicago in the 60s and 70s, and he wanted to add something to that that I thought was reasonable. He said we should be able to love and to work, and if we can do those two things, we are mostly healthy. But he thought real health requires that we add one thing to that, and that's to be able to feel some joy in the process. And I think that's absolutely essential, and I think that's part of what a good therapist and a good containing therapy would do. We can describe this in several different ways, and I don't want you to mistake the label for the reality of the human mind and its functioning in therapy. Therapy, you could describe it this way: to handle the truth of your life. The purpose of therapy is to help the patient handle, deal with, manage the truth of their individual lives. And if you can do that, if you can help a patient do that, then I think you've been successful as a therapist. Another way of thinking about it, and again, if you go back to my first lecture, these are like pieces of the elephant, the story of the seven blind wise men and the elephant. Strengthening the ego. If you can help the patient strengthen the ego, then that allows them to do all these other things. If you can allow them to resolve conflicts, these deep and abiding conflicts that make us, like Walt Whitman, quite contradictory creatures sometimes, then that's useful. Part of what good therapy does, I think as a derivative benefit, is that my patients, especially the ones I've seen for several years, they remember things. Memories come up that they've long since repressed. And in some way, good therapy, long-term therapy, allows them to remember and, I think, therefore, rediscover, take back, claim their lives in some ways. If you can help the patient remember through this process of unearthing the unconscious, helping the ego get strong enough to do this, then I think a patient's life can be transformed. The last way of thinking about this is the structural development, the development of the ego in relation to the other structural elements. That's the purposes. Those are the purposes, and they all go down, they turn around that same idea of bringing consciousness, unconscious dynamics to consciousness, and ultimately understanding the mind. It's not easy. And the one thing that patients always ask me is it difficult and painful? And the answer, sadly, the answer is yes. And there has never been a good therapy that's done all these things that hasn't in many ways been extraordinarily painful. And I tell patients up front that if you don't have the courage, if you don't have at least the semblance of self-confidence and will and strength to go through very difficult times, then maybe this kind of therapy isn't for you, that maybe you need something else. But to do this kind of therapy, the kind of therapy that Freud structured initially, this deep work about reclaiming in some ways your life and all of it, there's no way to do that that isn't painful, and that needs to be explained. Why is it so painful? And it seems to me that psychotherapy is painful because it requires us to shatter, to break, to at least bend all of the psychic elements that we've accumulated over time, all of these internalized relationships. If I had a fantasized relationship with my mom and dad, well, therapy, it's going to change. I'm going to, in the transference, work with my therapist. And I'm going to, in effect, generate a new sense of myself. But if I do that, then my old relationships very often have to change, sometimes have to break. And there's no way that's not going to generate psychic pain. Again, the philosopher Nietzsche had an artistic, kind of an aesthetic way of looking at it. He said, if a temple is to be built, a temple must be destroyed. And, you know, around here in Seattle, if you're going to build a building, you got to tear a building down. And I think that reality is why therapy is so painful and requires patients to be told up front, to be told honestly that this is not going to be easy and there will be tears. And fortunately, a good therapist can create a place, a space to contain these terrors, these anxieties that come out of the unconscious in powerful ways. That's maybe how the therapist does the job, contains the terrible anxieties that get unleashed in therapy. And if the therapist has had his or her own therapy and managed their own terrors, then they then and only then, I think, can help a patient manage theirs. Everybody wants to know the details. How does it work? What actually happens behind closed doors? So let me run through some quick details. How often should you see a therapist? And the answer is it's all over the map, but there's some guidance. It's not completely squishy. Most clinicians say minimum once a week. You can't establish a working relationship unless there's at least once a week therapy. I've had some exceptions to that, but they tend to be exceptions. How many times can you see a patient? Well, psychoanalysis, the most profound and deepest type of therapy, you can see a patient 4 or 5 times a week on the couch. If the therapist is qualified to do that. That's a lot of therapy. Some therapists, myself included, will see a patient not for 1 hour twice a week, but maybe 2 hours one time a week. That goes deeper. That goes in a much more profound way. So it varies quite a bit. It depends a lot on what the patient can handle, what the patient can afford, and there's just no way around those calculations. Should you sit on a chair facing the therapist, or should you lay on a couch like Freud's patients did? And the answer is it depends. Depends on what you need. Depends on what you can handle. Most patients sit in chairs, face the therapist once or twice a week. That seems to be the norm. Variations on that theme can be discussed with the therapist. Why lay on a couch? What's the couch about? Well, the joke was Freud just didn't like people looking at him 8 or 10 hours a day, and so he put him on the couch. Not true. Though he did make some reference to that in one of his writings. The main reason was to isolate the patient, to let their own mind come out without having to look at the therapist's facial expressions and reactions and try to distract themselves with what's going on in the patient, in the therapist's mind. It was a way to keep the therapy focused on the patient where it should be. And it's actually quite effective. Dream interpretation as a therapeutic tool remains profound and powerful. And the truth is, my patients never go deeper, faster, farther than when they come in and I successfully work with them to interpret their dreams in a profound way. Dream interpretation used to be very common in therapy. I think it's less so now, but in my experience still remains profoundly important. The nuts and bolts of the therapeutic relation are all about the transference. When a patient comes in and sits down and says something to me, I'm always thinking about what they're putting on me, what they're projecting on me about their previous object relationships, what they've accumulated in their experiences with their mothers and fathers and other people in their life. That's always something to keep in mind. I also keep in mind what I hear, what I see, what their body is doing, what their hands are doing. I am open to the feeling state, the emotional experience I get with them, as well as the nuances of their facial expression. Freud said you should be sort of a neutral blank screen. You should be like radar almost, taking in everything about what the patient is saying, feeling, doing, experiencing, reacting. You need all of that in order to formulate an interpretation that might be useful in bringing to consciousness what the patient's got going on. Does one interpretation work? No, it doesn't, almost never. Even if it's a good interpretation, even if it's a good dream interpretation, and the patient gets something, it goes back. Repression continues. It has to, over the course of months and sometimes years, be worked through, the working through process. One interpretation is not going to fix anything at any time, and any therapist that thinks they have such cool interpretations that they can fix the patient quickly hasn't done enough of their own therapy, I think. So working through is a difficult, slogging process, one step at a time, 2 steps forward, 1 step back sometimes. And a patient has to be told that this is a difficult, long process where progress comes in fits and starts. I think that's honest. I think that's realistic. And a patient needs to know that up front or they get discouraged very quickly. The stance of the therapist is, as Freud said, evenly hovering attention. That's his phrase. But we're not neutral. We're human beings in the room. I have feelings. I have desires. But they're not part of the therapeutic process directly. The therapist must be able to contain his or her own what we call countertransference. The therapist must focus his or her attention on the patient. If the therapist's own emotions are in chaos or in turmoil, if the patient says something that enrages the therapist, then he or she can't be a good therapist to that patient. That's why the second fundamental rule, Oh, the first fundamental rule that Freud laid down, actually his co-worker Ferenczi framed it, is that the patient simply comes in and free associates. That means the patient comes in and sits down and speaks whatever comes into their mind as freely as they can. Now, that's critical. You don't come in with a checklist. You don't... Okay, some patients come in with a checklist. They've got important things to say. You deal with it. But the idea is to let their mind roam a bit free, deal with what comes up, and trust their minds to show the therapist the patterns of their unconscious dynamics that then can be made to made conscious. And that's the core of the work. The second fundamental rule is that the therapist, him or herself, must be analyzed to rock bottom. The therapist has to do this work themselves. You could never take a patient deeper than you've been willing to go yourself. And the number one criteria for any therapist is how many years of therapy have they had? Would you want to learn martial arts from someone who read about martial arts in a book? No. Would you want a surgeon operating on you who learned it online? No. Why would you want a therapist who's just learned about psychology from reading books? You have to have a therapist who's done the experiential work themselves, or they're amateurs, or they're dangerous. The first question any therapy patient should ask any potential therapist is, how many years of therapy, doc, have you had? And if the answer isn't in multiples of years, it would be reasonable for that potential patient to go find someone who is qualified. That may be an extreme position. But in all of my clinical experience and all of my colleagues' experience that I'm familiar with, it is true. Termination. How does therapy end? What happens? Everybody get tired and quit? Well, sometimes. Sometimes patients blow the therapy up. Sometimes the therapist hasn't had enough of his own therapy and lets something get out of control. Sometimes they run out of money. Sometimes they move for career reasons. There's a million reasons. Some good, some reasonable, some legitimate that therapy would end. Most of the time when therapy ends, it's because the therapist has made a mistake. The therapist has not seen a transference dynamic. The therapist has not recognized something in their own acting out that's causing the patient a difficulty that causes them to flee. When it works, in those cases where it works, after years, and I don't know any good therapy that isn't going to take years to complete. The completion of a good therapy doesn't mean the patient is healed or cured. We don't do cure in therapy. We reveal as much of the unconscious as we can. We assist in the resolution of symptoms as best we can. But this isn't a medical model. You don't come to therapy because you've got something that's just mentally like the flu. That doesn't work. I'm not curing anyone. And any therapist that holds themselves out that much like a medical doctor is probably sorely mistaken and misguided. We terminate when I can no longer take the patient any deeper, when I've given everything I have to the patient, and I've helped the patient reveal all of their unconscious that they can, given my limitations. And when that happens, the therapist should realize it, and if the work's gone well, the patient realizes it. And you move into a termination phase where the focus of the work becomes the ending of the work itself and the terminating of what has been, hopefully, a healthy, nurturing, containing relationship. And for the first time in the patient's life, perhaps, a relationship ends in a healthy way and not just blowing up with leavings and recriminations. And it's in that termination phase that I think really the work gets solidified. The patient's ego gets really profoundly strengthened and supported, and the person then goes off into the world, able to love, able to work, and with any luck, feeling some joy in the process. The last thing I want to say is how the field, the classic field of psychoanalysis, is now branching out into social psychology. I'll spend an entire lecture on how this way of thinking will affect group psychology, social psychology. It is where the cutting edge is now, I think, in my field, that and neurological science. But we'll save that for another day. The short version of it is simply this, that groups act psychotically. because they contain the individual's psychotic processes. One of the things that we do periodically in America is have elections. And one of the things that I've constantly been amazed at is how crazy things get around election time, is that people who are normally seemingly sane get hooked up into groups, and the groups are screaming at each other, and there's violence threatened. And you don't have to go that far to see groups killing each other over what seems trivial differences. You can't turn on the television today and watch a news program without people screaming at each other. And I thought, well, this just seems barbaric. And I realized now, using these ways of thinking, that what happens is the crazy part of all of us, and this is an innovation in the classical thinking, that we don't develop in a linear way. We develop by the accumulation of experiences, so that we don't have to go a long way to get crazy, because we bring crazy with us. We just have to go right here. And that crazy is hard to contain. Hopefully a strong ego can do that. But if it can't, what happens is we take the crazy parts of us and put them out there. Paranoid people do that most overtly. But I think groups in politics do that, and all the bad goes out onto the evil Democrats or the evil Republicans, and we're the good ones, we're all good. And you see people using defense mechanisms like splitting, where they put all the good over here and all the bad over there. Why? Because they can't stand the idea that they have some bad in them. They can't stand the idea that they have some part of them that isn't right and true and fair and just. And they hate that, so they split and they project, and all the bad's out there, and they feel justified in doing anything to those people because they're so bad. Wow, all of a sudden, using this understanding of how individuals grow, we may now have the ability to understand groups that are perhaps our gravest danger. So a little teaser for later lectures. My hope is that what you have learned is that therapy depends on the quality and the reality-based nature of the theory of mind of the clinician. That can only be sophisticated through their own decades-long training and personal therapy, and that the goal of this entire endeavor is to help other people grow and get stronger, to help ourselves grow and get stronger, to, at a very fundamental level, take a stance of understanding and respect. And whenever we catch ourselves as clinicians being judgmental, being condemning, or being directive, as if we know the answers to this person's life, both of those things are destructive, it seems. And the answer for good therapy is simply fostering an understanding. In a humble way, create a place, a therapy room, where the patient can come in and feel safer than he's ever or she's ever felt in her life anywhere else, and engage in techniques and engage in a dialogue that understands the complexity of the human mind, so that that person sitting in front of you can leave understanding themselves and ultimately feeling strong enough to manage their internal conflicts and the conflicts that life throw at us every day. If you can do that, we'll all be better off. Thank you very much. See you next time.